Thank you. So I think I don't have to say to this audience that questions are welcome. I see Mark Średnicki, so I wouldn't expect otherwise. While I welcome questions, I reserve the right to suppress them on occasion. So what I shall talk about is edition from Guano to Classical. The center point is going to be Born's rule and how to derive it from entanglement, from the symmetries of entanglement. I shall actually start with very brief summary of decoherence. I am supposed to give a physics colloquium in a few more weeks. If you want to hear more about decoherence, there is going to be more about decoherence there. In a sense, the theme of what I'm going to say is how to go beyond decoherence, both to sort of deeper level of foundations and in terms of reach of the consequences. Let me start by giving you a brief summary of postulates which one would be able to extract about basic quantum theory from good textbooks, and by good textbooks I mean things like Dirac. To me, it's still the Bible. Postulates 1 and 2. Quantum states live in Hilbert spaces. Physical import of that is quantum superposition principle. And evolutions are unitary, generated by Schrodinger equation. These first two rules are purely mathematics. They make absolutely no connection between physics and mathematics. We do calculations using 1 and 2, but at this point we are just shuffling symbols. So there is no connection with physics whatsoever. The first rule that begins to make that connection is number 3. Immediate repetition of a measurement yields the same outcome. I would call it repeatability or predictability, depending on the context. It is a rule that experimentalists know is exceedingly hard to implement in practice. Non-demolition measurements are difficult. But it is also a rule which I think is really important to get physics and mathematics together and to get it consistent. Because the simplest, the role of a state is to make predictions. And the simplest prediction one can make is that the state is what it is. And number 3 allows you to confirm it. Now, the next one is in red for a purpose. Rules 1, 2, and 3, I would say, are non-controversial. Number 3 begins to touch on the area of transition between quantum and classical, and it does it like Bohr and Dirac would have done it. It says outcomes of measurements are restricted to orthonormal states, eigenstates of the measured observable. The other way of stating it is observables are Hermitian, and that just one outcome is seen each time. This is a collapse postulate. A already restricts the sorts of things you can measure. We will try to understand how much of that one can understand without assuming it, but above all, we will concentrate on rule number 5. Probability of finding an outcome is given by the square of the amplitude. Now, in addition to all of these, there is one rule which is not in Dirac, but which we use in our daily lives, especially if we do quantum information, which is that a state of a composite system lives in a tensor product of the Hilbert spaces of the constituents. For future reference, let me write down some of them if I find a chalk here. So rule number 0 is H of A, B is H of A, H of B. Rule number 1, live in Hilbert space of some system. Yes.
Flip the switch next to the blackboard.
Okay. Rule number two is state after a time t is some unitary operator times state. So this is at time zero. Number three, I'm just going to say repeatability. And number four and five are, let me just say, for A, observables are Hermitian, and B, one outcome, per run of a measurement, and five, Born's rule. Yes.
You were just stressing the point that the first two axioms are complete pure mathematics.
Yes.
Now, how do you see the fifth one? Because one could argue that probability is also a priori just math.
And I don't disagree, right? And in fact, decoherence is done in this spirit, and I'm going to say it. But you know, you gave me the occasion to do it now. So basically, 0 through 3 plus 5 form a consistent set of postulates which one can work with. And doing decoherence, we usually do that. We assume probabilities are like that. I'm going to complain about number five for other reasons. I would like to understand it better. But this is a perfectly good set of postulates. But if this light stays on over there, is that disturbing the view of the screen?
It just seems like three is different than one or two in the sense.
Yes.
A measurement has to be defined, maybe, or at least should be stated.
Yes, so, and we're going to do that, right? But for now, measurement is going to be a unitary evolution of joint state of the system and the apparatus.
So also, the zero is not obvious if you start working with fermions, no?
Sorry?
If you work with fermions, zero is not obvious.
I agree.
A lot of tensor products, so how do you...
I bypass it, right? I'm just going to state it the way it, I'm going to use it, right? But I think there are subtleties, right? So on one hand, there are situations in which I think zero is so obvious you don't need to say it almost, because it sort of follows from the structure of Hilbert spaces. On the other hand, there are situations where it's helpful.
Right? In particular, in gravity, that's quite subtle. Zero is...
I'm not going to touch gravity because it hasn't been quantized. So I'm going to stay away. But I think it's...
Not true. You know, you
okay.
Sort of weak field gravity and the quantum theory of that and treat it perturbatively, et cetera. It's true there are problems like renormalizability.
So I would like to hear more about this. I mean, for now, I'm going to do it the way people do it when they do quantum computing. Most of the time. But I think it's interesting, and I think, you know, how much of zero can be deduced from, and how much is it consistent with the rest is an interesting problem worth pursuing. Zero through two are only math. Number three begins to make contact with physics. In a way which is non-controversial in a sense that we are used to repeatability in classical world as well. What I'm going to do, and that's sort of the plan of the talk, is to use 0 through 3 and see how much of 4 and 5 I can deduce. And the underlying question that's sort of motivating this is, why do we perceive our quantum world, because we know, you know, constituents are quantum, as classical? So, the answer given by decoherence. Decoherence uses 0 through 3, plus, as was already pointed out, Born's rule. What you say is the systems are, especially macroscopic, are generally impossible to isolate from their environments. As a result of interactions, they entangle. That entanglement means that you have some sort of joint density, joint state of the system and the environment. If you are introduced in the system alone, you can trace out the environment and you get a density matrix of the system. And habitually, this density matrix ends up being orthogonal, being diagonal in the same set of states, if you fix the interaction and so on. I shouldn't say even said habitually, typically, or you know, in many cases of interest or of relevance for transition to quantum to classical. In other words, if you were to start in one of these lucky states which end up on the diagonal, nothing would happen. The system would just stay in it. These are the preferred pointer states. This is called environment-induced superselection, or for short, Ein selection. We understand how this process happens in various situations. It is clear that the interaction Hamiltonian that couples the system to the environment plays a key role. In particular, if no other Hamiltonians are around, then if these projectors commute with this Hamiltonian, nothing will happen to them. So this is a very idealized situation where, you know, by hand you pick out a set of states that will survive interaction with the environment. You can analyze it in more complicated situations. I should not, at least not here. I will say more about it during the physics colloquium, but Hamiltonians matter. Very simple example. Let me suppose I have a spin or a qubit in this initial state, and I have an interaction which couples this spin with an environment of a whole bunch of other spins, which is diagonal in the state 0 and 1, so sigma 0. Right? This interaction is going to take this initial pure state, same thing as this, into a mixture which is going to be approximately diagonal in the states, which are the eigenstates, partial eigenstates of this interaction Hamiltonian. Straightforward. So these states, 0 and 1, are going to be pointer eigenstates. Preferred observable is going to be correlated with the environment. This defines pointer states that survive decoherence. This is a trivial situation. You can consider it in more complicated situations where you do not have a perfect observable commuting with the Hamiltonian, where you have a self-Hamiltonian which doesn't commute with this Hamiltonian, etc., etc., etc. There's no guarantee you will find pointer states. In fact, we know that there are situations where there's no preferred basis. So-called perfect depolarizing channel treats or mistreats all of the bases equally badly, right? However, you can look for them with a simple strategy. You write all the states in the Hilbert space, and I don't mean a single basis, I mean every superposition of every superposition. You evolve all of them for a while with whatever evolution is dictated by whatever Hamiltonians do it to the system, and at the end you can calculate how badly were they damaged and how badly I can quantify using, for example, from Neumann's entropy. The ones which were damaged least, which are least mixed, would be the best preserved. If I had a perfect commutation, there would be a bunch of pure states here on the top. In general, it won't happen. So, you know, trying to summarize multi-dimensional Hilbert space with two-dimensional picture, there is going to be a peak which will sort of pinpoint which states are most stable. Now in practice, it often makes sense. Yeah, so entropy is your criterion. So you basically have a functional which assigns to states in the Hilbert space numbers, and then you sort these states in the Hilbert space so that least entropies are near the top. Sometimes, in fact, often, in fact, almost always, it's easier to calculate just ratio square, which is pure. Right? And it's going to give you a very similar list. And if there is a well-defined set of preferred states, they're going to end up on the top. And it's possible that you will end up empty-handed. So, nice story. It picks out preferred states. Pointer state means you end up with specific definite records, so you sort of have events. You have it in the context of axioms from over there, and so you are done. So why complain? Well, we want to derive Born's rule. We want to understand if it can get from something deeper. So I'm going to complain. Oh yeah, simple way of saying what do pointer states do is actually to point that they don't do something. They entangle least with the environment. Okay, so why am I complaining about it? Nice story. Right? The problem is that this object, reduced density matrix, comes from averaging. So while taking a trace is a mathematical procedure, no objections, interpreting density matrix as a physical object, one can object to. So this step, which is key in all the calculations done in decoherence, depends on Born's rule. So in other words, one should, and we will, for much of this talk, abstain from at least interpreting density matrix as a physical object. It also means that this nice result about how to select preferred bases, etc., using von Neumann entropy and so on, is no longer justified. If we give up Born's rule, we have to start from scratch. Now, in order to get to Born's rule, we will somehow still need to have preferred events, things that happen. Before, we got them as pointer states, and now we need to do it somehow differently. We need to get them without being able to trace. So how do we go about it? And let me just state the overall program. Want to derive as much of 4 and 5 as possible out of 0 through 3. First, we're going to try to see why measurement outcomes are limited to an orthogonal set of possible states in the Hilbert space. Second, Born's rule. Third, how does classical reality emerge? Let's start from number 1. And we have our hands tied. No trace, no decoherence. Turns out it's actually simple. And this is what I will understand by a measurement. So I consider two states, U and V, that can be found out, measured by an apparatus A, but remain unchanged. Apparatus A starts in a state A0 and ends up in a state AU or AV, depending on whether the system was in the state U or V. Right? Both systems and the apparatus are quantum. Repeatability is reflected in the fact that U remains U. So I could bring another copy of the apparatus and I would keep on getting the same results over and over. Right? So repeatability is used up front. So what does it give us? That's a key thing, and I'm going to shorten a slightly longer derivation by pointing out that because this evolution is unitary, products of the left-hand sides and right-hand sides must be equal. Scalar products of left-hand sides and right-hand sides must be equal. So I get a very simple equation. UV A0, A0 is equal to UV AU AV. Now, if you have an equation like this, a temptation is to simplify. Right? You have the same factor on both sides.
I'm a bit confused. How can you sort of get some information about U into A without changing U at all? Why is that the unitary process? Because it sounds like you can't go backwards.
Yeah, you can go backwards. You could apply the Hamiltonian which generated this unitary and revolve it backwards. And we know that if the Hamiltonian has as eigenstates U and V, it will do it.
It's like his qubit model earlier.
Yeah, that's right. It's controlled knot, right? In fact, controlled knot is called measurement gate sometimes for sort of this reason. So, I got from this to here. I've got this very simple equation, and now the temptation is divide by the common factor. So if we divide by the common factor, disaster happens. AU AV is equal to 1. We've proved measurement couldn't have happened, right? AU must be equal to AV, so there is absolutely no imprint of the state of the system on the environment, on the apparatus. So have we just proved from our set of postulates that measurements are impossible? Well, not quite. Simplification was a rash step. We shouldn't have done it. And the reason we shouldn't have done it is that there is a possibility that this scalar product was zero. In fact, only when the scalar product is zero, meaning U and V are orthogonal, you will be able to measure repeatably in a way which distinguishes them. So this is, you know, really straightforward derivation of preferred sets of states. It shows right away why observables, at least the way Dirac liked them, have to be Hermitian. They're going to have orthogonal eigenstates, which gives you hermeticity. Any questions at this point? Okay, so you've bought it, or you are confused by it thoroughly. In any case, yes.
Why an assumption?
This one?
That you can, yes.
Yes. Well, I mean, I am assuming that you will stay you, right? That's an assumption.
It doesn't seem like that's the residual measure.
It changes the state of another system depending on the state of the system. I don't know what real measurement is, right? So, in your language. But it is a measurement in the sense that I have another system which has an imprint of the state of you.
Maybe. Yeah. You say that's an assumption that follows from 1 and 0 to 3?
Yes. Repeatability. U stays U. Therefore, I can come up with another apparatus in a state A0, and I'm going to get a sequence of AU, 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 AU here, repeatable.
Well, you're assuming that that's possible, but then you're going to use this as a definition of what it means to be found out, or whatever.
This is what I'm going to use as a definition of a measurement which is repeatable, right? End of story. There are measurements which are not repeatable, and I'm going to relax it in various ways. And you can relax it in various ways right away. For example, it's enough if U evolves into U tilde and V evolves into V tilde as long as U and U tilde and V tilde are orthogonal, right? So you can follow things which are evolving. But we're going to talk about this more. Yes.
Without doing that, it would really constitute a non-demolition.
This would be a non-demolition measurement. Yes. Now, predictability implies restriction to orthogonal states. So there is a discreteness which shows up, which is directly inherited from predictability or repeatability, or however you want to call it. Discreteness hints at collapse. Now, there is no collapse, right? It's unitary, right? But if you are, you know, looking at the apparatus, sequence of apparata, and you see that you have nothing before, but then you had AU, 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 then the system that you've measured seems to have collapsed into the state U. Now, there are branches, and I'm not going to go into interpretations, and I'm going to, you know, avoid both of them like a plague.
Yeah, but what if you relax that to say within error?
it's not going to give me what I want yet, but it's going to be a case where we can come back to, where you can do the relaxation. So, derivation of quantum jumps, key to collapse postulate, we have it. And we've got it without decoherence. It implies observables are Hermitian because the eigenstates are orthogonal. Proof is similar to no cloning. Proof can be extended to when the apparatus environment is initially in a mixed state. That's fairly straightforward. As well as to mixed decohering systems. Let me finish the list and I'll call on you. And I'm going to come back to the blue one in the next transparency. Repeatability was clearly key to the proof. Information transfer need not be deliberate. Any system sucking out information out of the system of interest is and leaving some of its states unperturbed is going to have the same effect. And that was a question.
So, something confuses me, because if I read the first three axioms,
yes,
then there is at no point a connection made in these axioms between the state of the system and the measurement, because axiom 3 just says if I repeat it, I get the same
yes.
result. But it doesn't say that the result in any way depends on the system state. So the system state, according to the first three axioms, would have in principle nothing to do with the measurement outcome. So in some way, I don't see where does the connection between the system, the state of the system, and the measurement outcome come in.
So I think we are sort of delving into details, but let me try to give you an answer, right? So measurement clearly to me is something which couples two systems. One of them I'm going to call the systems, the other I'm going to call the measurement, right? Measurement is successful if the system imprints in any way, if it changes the state of the apparatus in a way which depends on the state of the system, right? It happened here in our previous transparency, right? In fact, I think I'm glad you've called me back, because I do not want a perfect measurement. AU and AV do not need to be orthogonal. Any imprint, any tiny change which makes AU, AV less than one implies orthogonality. So any transfer of information. Right? But my measurement, I do understand about it as an interaction between two systems, one of which I'm going to call the system is the other apparatus, but you know, these names are optional. It's going to be environment or observer or something or other. I don't know if it helps.
Maybe just to comment a little further. Like if you take the postulate number one as completeness, and you say the state has all the information about the system, then in some sense I would say like, you know, if the state does not depend at all, if the state of the apparatus does not depend at all on the state of the system, then that's, you know, that. So I think it just follows from completeness.
Yes.
The completeness of the theory.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, so we went through this. Let me come back to the mixed decohering systems, right? So one problem with what I've just told you is that non-demolition measurements are so darn difficult. In fact, we never make them. In fact, when you measure a photon, you generally eat up the photon. So you do not really expect repeatability where Dirac had it and where I had it on my first transparency. Doesn't happen on the microscopic level. Where it does happen and where you do depend on it is when you care about the records which are deposited in the apparatus. I mean, you better be able to come back to the apparatus, take another look at it and see, oh yeah, it's still pointing at 17, right? And that should stay. So, you know, we've done a nice derivation for the case where it doesn't, which is not well motivated. Where we need to repeat something like that is at a macroscopic level. Now, at the macroscopic level, you know, apparatus is plugged into the wall, temperature of the room changes, entropy can increase or decrease depending on temperature, somebody can kick it and it still should point at 17. So clearly it's not going to be this sensitive. So the question is, what do we do now? So you should recognize that a macroscopic apparatus will have a record which is not a single microscopic state but a macroscopic state, which means a collection of microstates, and that that collection of microstates should be insensitive to being plugged in the wall, room temperature changes, and being kicked. And you can do that. Interestingly, you can do that. So you imagine a bunch of microstates, all of which produce the same record in the extra apparatus, right? So, you know, here my system is going to be composed of macroscopic states, and my apparatus is going to check if it's still pointing at 17. So U1, U2, and a whole bunch of other states are going to be resulting in the same record. Right? Now, if I want to carry out the same or pursue the same story as before, I have to consider record corresponding to U and record corresponding to V. So, you know, there's going to be a whole bunch of states. Any superposition of these states is going to obviously give me still the same record U. Any mixture of these states is going to still give me a record U. And I'm going to now consider a different subspace of the system, V. Every superposition would give me record V, and every mixture is going to give me record V here. Right? So what happens now? Turns out what you can show basically by looking at Hilbert-Schmidt norm, so you do the same thing as before but for density matrices, is that as this ought to change, decrease, as you keep on making more copies, the only way to satisfy it is for these density matrices corresponding to one record and the other record to live or to be supported, to have a support in orthogonal Hilbert subspaces, right? So here we have a notion of imprecision, of resilience to noise changes of temperature, etc. In fact, here we have a possibility of error, because now you can imagine that, you know, these states which are kicked around but only gently sometimes wander around to the wrong subspace. I'm not going to consider that. Turns out you can push this further, and I'm just going to show a few slides. Basically, what you can show is that even under decoherence, you know, this basic conclusion holds. There is more to say here. I won't. Please.
So do you assume that the values that you can measure don't apply in a continuum?
Yes. In fact, here I am, because they are supported by orthogonal Hilbert spaces, right? So there is discreteness, right? In fact, that's my case. But, you know, in some sense, you know, once you have systems which are large and where states can wander from one to the other and so on, continues can kind of sneak in. Questions, comments? Okay. So now we have distinguishable events, things that can happen. They correspond to these orthogonal subspaces of Hilbert spaces, orthogonal records, orthogonal states. So we are back to our program. We are done with having candidates for events. We've shown while Hermitian observables are Hermitian operators are observables. We've also understood why repeatability is really more appropriate and more crucial at the level of records of the apparatus rather than at the level of microscopic quantum systems. Question?
Maybe you already addressed this and I missed it, but you were talking about the need for the record to be stored in macroscopic
objects or property, and then you started talking about subspaces.
Yes.
I can see how the two are similar concepts. I am familiar with macro states from talking about classical systems, though, and I'm familiar with subspaces from talking about quantum systems. It's not obvious to me that those should be exactly the same thing. For instance, I think of a macroscopic property as characterizing an entire material, the whole temperature of a large body of a gas. Whereas I think of a subspace as not necessarily as being disanalogous in some ways. For instance, suppose that we have a chain of spins, and suppose that my observable is a sigma z defined all the way on one spin on the left-hand side. That corresponds, that has a very highly degenerate subspace associated with the plus one eigenvalue. But that's a characteristic of just one spin in the whole chain. So it feels like this property isn't really a macro state in the sense of a temperature that characterizes the whole material. So are these macro states really subspaces? Or macroscopic properties really subspaces?
So what I am doing is sort of starting from the different end, right? I mean, you are starting with condensed matter physics, and yes, you can have situations where macrostates will mean something different than they mean in the context of measurements. I am thinking of where I want a preservation of a property, right? And a preservation of a property for a macrostate means that the microstate can be allowed to wander through the Hilbert space and yet represent the same property.
So would it be possible for me to take your arguments and replace every instance with macrostate with subspace, more or less, and replace more or less every instance of microstate with some state within the subspace? Could I just eliminate the language of macrostates if I wanted to?
I think so.
Okay, thanks.
Okay. Anything else that's urgent before we push out? Okay, so let's push on. So now we want to now we have an idea of events. We want to understand why does Born rule yield probabilities. Now there are two basic approaches. Actually, there's a whole bunch of different schools of how to derive probabilities from something or other. There is, of course, axiomatization due to Kolmogorov. He says probability is basically a measure theory. He tells you the rules how to manipulate probabilities once you have them for elementary events. Our task is different. We want to calculate what the probabilities are in terms of states in the Hilbert space. So we want to relate elementary probabilities to states in the Hilbert space. One way of doing it, which is done in most textbooks, is looking at numbers of events as statistics. How many times something has happened. And this is known as relative probabilities approach, relative frequencies approach to probabilities. This approach has been tried on quantum mechanics with some success, Jim Hartle. But in the context of where you have only quantum mechanics, where you only have quantum rules, it has basically failed. I'm not going to discuss why. I'm going to try something else. Something else is actually an older approach to probabilities that goes back to French mathematicians of, I think, 18th century, and that goes back to French aristocrats of more or less the same time. They played games of chance. They were not very good at betting, so they lost vast amounts of money. So they funded French mathematicians to teach them how to bet more successfully. This is the origin of probability theory. It was codified by Laplace. There was a massive book that he kept on rewriting because he wasn't happy with it. And I will tell you why he wasn't happy with it. He had good reasons. So my approach is based, as Laplace's approach, on symmetry. I want to find elementary events which have demonstrably equal probability. Once I have that, I will be able to proceed.
Question?
Question.
Ha!
Here it is. It's a genuine question. I'm not going to object to anything.
Really?
Yeah. I'm still not clear on how you're going to treat probability in quantum mechanics. Let me give an analogy. In classical mechanics, most people would say we don't need probability at all. We can...
Yes.
Okay. But if I'm uncertain about the classical state of a system, then I might use probability. I could define a probability distribution on phase space. I could time evolve it. I could derive rules that this probability distribution has to satisfy, blah, blah, blah. But most of us would say that's an extraneous concept. I did not need to bring it in. What would you say the same is true of quantum mechanics?
Why don't you repeat the question after we are done with this? I think it's going to be easier to answer it.
Alright.
Okay? But yes, an interesting question. So, back to Laplace and French aristocrats. So here they are playing cards. There are two cards, face down. One of them is definitely a spade. And I'm playing with them and I'm desperate to have a spade in my hand. So Laplace's idea was, look, if you are indifferent to shuffling and getting the card which is closest to you after shuffling, that means your assessment, your subjective assessment of probability of getting a spade is 1/2. Now, based on ignorance, Marcus already brought up the subject. However, and again, as Marcus brought it up, if you are sitting under the table and the table is made out of glass, physical state of the cards clearly changes. And this is really what derailed Laplace's program. I mean, he wanted to have some objective theory of something or other, but he had to base it on symmetry, which was on the invariance, which was based on the mind of the observer. And this was unsatisfying. And this is why it got replaced later on largely by relative frequencies approach, which I think is equally bad, but that's a different story. Now, the point is, what Laplace was missing is entanglement. So let me now play the card game the way quantum mechanics allows us to. So here I have two cards, one sitting on table S, and it's entangled its state with a card sitting on table E. Okay? I'm going to shuffle cards on table S. After shuffling, this Bell state becomes this Bell state. Right? It changes. These two are orthogonal. They are different states. However, I can restore the state of the whole thing without touching table S. How do I do that? Well, shuffle the cards on the other table. So the basic point will be that if I can swap things and then restore the state of the whole without unswapping things I swapped, the probabilities must be swapped and yet remains the same, so they must be equal. So let's do it a bit more carefully. So I'm gonna define entanglement assisted invariance, and you know, entangled states are going to be my key and only example. So I have here a Schmidt decomposition of a joint state of system and the environment. It could be Alice and Bob or whatever. Schmidt states are, of course, also normal, and alpha k are complex. Unitary transformation with Schmidt eigenstates, so an operator like this, leaves this state invariant. Why? Well, it's simple, right? I apply this to this state. Phases of alphas increase by phi k's, but I can undo this by applying the opposite direction of rotation to the phases of the environment. Where do I have it? Yeah. So I can, there's an algebra problem here. But I can, you know what I'm saying, right? I mean, I rotate things one way, and I rotate minus I phi k, E k, E k. Right? So the state can be restored. I get what I had before. So, locally, Schmidt phases do not matter. This smacks of decoherence. In fact, this is sort of decoherence as a local entanglement-assisted symmetry. Decoherence at this level can be understood as resulting from invariance, from the fact that the system is entangled with something else. Question?
So why does anyone care that, I mean, so for the example of the cards, it's easy to just reshuffle again.
Yes.
But if you're talking about a system in the large environment, then of course the invariance implemented by the environment would have been very complicated to engineer. Why does
yes.
anyone care about that?
Well, so first of all, as I think we all know, if you have a system which has two states, an environment which has 10 to the 23 states, the Schmidt decomposition is only two terms. Right? So even though you may have to act on something horrible over there, it's in principle possible.
But
right?
It's very delocalized.
Sorry? It's very delocalized and it's horrible. But our point is not so much that we're going to do it. Our point is that there is no local property corresponding to the phases because someone else with sufficiently, etc., powers could have done it, right? So that means that local state does not depend on phases, okay? Question?
I might have missed something obvious, but how are we defining invariance that starts with an E rather than an I?
Environment-assisted invariance. Sorry. Actually, it was originally environment-assisted. That's what I said, yeah. It was originally environment-assisted invariance until David Mermin pointed out to me that environments are messy, and I shouldn't use that, and that a much better justification for invariance is entanglement-assisted. So that's what I go with. Okay, let's do it more carefully, because that's sort of the part. I mean, I think you are convinced of the result, but let's prove it more carefully. And, you know, there are three things we know about quantum mechanics that are going to be useful and that are going to be important. So quantum fact number one, if a unitary transformation doesn't act on this system but on some other system, the state of this system is not going to change. Right? So if...
And here, by state, you have like object used to do physical predictions, right?
Object to do... To,
it's
exactly.
Not a mathematical state.
Exactly. It doesn't have to be pure state. In fact, this is sort of the way to smuggle in mixed states without trace row or you know, tracing or reduce the...
You kind of change state by physical predictions, right?
Yes, that's right. Exactly. And, you know, that physical prediction business comes in already here. The state of the system is all that is necessary available to predict measurement outcomes, including their probabilities, right? And quantum fact number three, a state of the composite system is all that is needed available to determine the state of the system. So if you have something bigger and you know its state, then whatever you know about that state is going to determine what you know about the substate. So, moreover, entanglement happens. So, theorem one, state and probabilities of S alone can depend only on the absolute values of Schmidt coefficients and not on their phases. And let me go just step by step for completeness. Phases of alpha can be changed by acting on S alone, but the act of the whole can be restored by acting only on E, by invariance. So by fact three, state of S can also be restored, right? I've restored the state of the whole thing So I must have restored the state of whatever is local. However, by fact one, state of S could not have been changed by acting on the ANE. Right? So I didn't do anything to S. I just did something somewhere else. So by fact two, change of phases of Schmidt coefficients could not have affected the state of S, QED. Okay. So, by phase invariance, absolute values of amplitudes and paired up with states must provide a complete local description of the state of S alone. Right, so it's the same info as reduced density matrix. We don't yet know Born's rule. So we don't yet know probabilities. Or what probabilities are. Looks like you undecided whether you want to ask something or not. Go for it.
Can you motivate a little bit more the fact too? Why is it that it's only the same?
It's a definition of a state. The right? There is something.
Measurement is performed by the apparatus which is outside the system.
Measurement is performed by the apparatus, by NEO, by something, right? And there is a state somewhere there of the system alone which is entangled with some other stuff and so on and so forth, right? And I want to assess what are the probabilities, right? In fact, I have a simpler task. I want to prove there are situations where probabilities of certain things are equal, right? Assessing probability is going to come later, right? And symmetry of these states is going to give me the tools necessary to prove equality of probabilities. So if the state doesn't change under swapping things, probabilities of swapped things have to be equal. Cards from transparency number one. Okay. So, let us now go to a simpler case where amplitudes are equal. And this is a case for which we're going to prove equality of probabilities. So, the only thing that's here is phase, and I could have actually dropped it because we already proved that nothing depends on phases. And in this case, any orthonormal basis is Schmidt. Right? So, we could rewrite it on any other basis. That's no surprise. But we can now swap state SK with SL in this sum. Right? It's the same operation as with the cards before. And this operation gives me a new entangled state, which is different. But now I can restore the pre-existing state by swapping EL with EK. And adjusting phases as necessary, although it doesn't matter, right? So this means that here I can make the same argument for equality of probabilities I've made before. You know, the swapping of states when the amplitudes are equal doesn't matter. It would matter if the amplitudes, absolute values of amplitudes were not equal. I wouldn't be able to restore the original state. So now I can go through the reasoning as before. You know, the state of the whole got restored, therefore the local state must have been restored, but the local state of the thing has not been affected by transformation which was applied over there. So probabilities couldn't have changed, so they must be equal.
So this applies to anything, not just probability. If I invented a new concept, blobabilities.
Yes.
You have now proven the blobabilities are equal.
Providing your blobabilities can entangle. Providing states underlying blobabilities can entangle.
Okay. Blobabilities are properties of these states.
Yes.
So you've proven blobabilities.
Yes, I've proven the equality of something. Right?
Okay.
Now, and I'm glad you've reminded me of it, entanglement is crucial. I couldn't do it with classical objects. Right? So imagine I have a state of two coins, and they are both, you know, face, I mean, they are classical, so they are face down. Right? I flip one of them. No amount of effort exerted on the other coin is going to restore the state of the whole. So in that case, I cannot derive probability from the properties of a pure state. Right? I could derive probabilities from the properties of a mixed state. If I have two coins and I say they are same face down, then I could go through a similar reasoning and I could get blob abilities. So it's important, right? And I mean, the key thing here is that the entangled, states of composite objects in quantum mechanics live, I mean, axiom zero, live in a tensor product spaces. Pure states of classical objects live in Cartesian products of spaces. If you claim you know a state of a composite classical object, that means you know the state of every component of that composite object. Not so in quantum mechanics, and that's crucial. That was the ingredient Laplace was missing. Question?
So why can't you restore the state in the probabilistic case? Like, imagine you have two coins and you like take them together and flip them. Now it's
not entanglement. There is a Hamiltonian interaction between the two. Here is just entanglement. There's no interaction, right? So unitarity. My fact number one is horribly violated. You are not acting unitarily just over there. You have this sort of thing which is non-local, which is doing this in both places.
Yeah. But it seems like there's a pretty analogous effect in the case of correlation. That so, if you're after that, your probability distribution is like half probability of heads heads, half probability of tails tails. And
absolutely.
You close your eyes and cut the things apart. If you flip one, now it's half tails heads and half heads tails. You keep your eyes closed, flip the other, and now you've got your original probability.
Yeah, but you have to start with ignorance, and so you have to start with probabilities.
Yeah.
The advantage here is I start with certainty. And give you probabilities, right?
What so, you've only given us blob abilities.
You had to do it. No, I'm giving you probabilities, right? I mean, you know, the outcomes, there is n outcomes, n possible outcomes. One of them is going to happen, just one, right? Call it whatever you want. Your assessment of what will happen from before is 1 over n. And in fact, let me go a bit further. Right, so, you know, the operation on the bottom, the swap on the bottom was, you know, the same thing in different notation. And I can prove by normalization that in this case, probabilities of all of these things are 1 over n when there is n things with non-zero coefficients. Equal non-zero coefficients. Question?
This is a stupid idea, but why is it clear that these probabilities that are equal are not zero? And the actual thing that's happening is the thing which is outside the range of the state. I mean, a priori, if I don't know anything about this connection, it could be that the outcome is always something orthogonal to the state.
Well, so, you know, so what I'm thinking here is the whole thing is quantum, right? So I am quantum or the apparatus is quantum and so on, right? So I'm going to have this thing, right? And I know that this is the state before I correlate with it. And then I walk up to it and measure it. And because, you know, the coefficients are equal, it doesn't matter in what basis, right? It is clear by symmetry that me being able to register any of these outcomes is 1 over n, right? In other words, if after that I keep on making the same measurement by repeatability, I'm going to get a sequence of confirmations, right? So I'm going to be in a situation where beforehand I had a state which was a superposition of possibilities. I was able to prove they are equal. Afterwards, just one of them happened.
Maybe to have a concrete example, let's say we have a three-dimensional space.
Yes.
If basis states 1, 2, and 3, and I have an entangled state that only involves components 1 and 2, but not 3.
Yes.
Now, let's suppose I do the measurement and get out
yes.
from 3. Which of the axioms is now violated?
So there is one more thing that I didn't say, and I didn't prove, and I can prove. And that is if the if the component here appears with a coefficient 0, it's probably zero.
Okay. That was missing.
Yeah.
Okay.
So you can prove it, and the proof is actually okay. I'm not going to do it, but it's possible, right? And it has
based on the axioms you made.
Yeah, it's based on the. I think I will need actually four states for that, because I need the way to do it is you split the thing which has coefficient 0 into two things which have coefficient 0, right? And then you can prove that the probabilities have to be equal, and have to be equal to what was there before, and that gives you zero. Okay.
Does that top expression assume that SK and SL for K not equal to L are different?
Yes, or the Fesch-Schmidt decomposition.
Yeah, but I'm confused about the dimensionality of your S's and the dimensionality of the environment.
It's a Schmidt decomposition, which means that in that Schmidt decomposition you have the same dimensionality, which is relevant, right? Okay. As I said before, if you have a system which has two states, an environment which has 10 to the 23 states, the whole thing is pure, then there are only two terms in Schmidt decomposition. It's a theorem which predates quantum mechanics, so it must be true. Okay, anything else before we move on?
How are you going to show that these things that Mark calls probabilities satisfy the rules of classical probability, like conditional probabilities and that kind of thing?
Yeah, you can do that, right? I'm not going to go through it here. I'm going to go first and tell you what happens if the amplitudes are not equal, because that's sort of a more urgent task.
Okay.
And that's the real Born rule, right? But you can show that they are, that the... Okay, so an example, a case with unequal coefficients. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to reduce cases with unequal coefficients to cases with equal coefficients, right? And then I'm going to know what the other what probabilities are equal, and this will give me probabilities in the general case. So consider a system with two states, state 0 and state 2, right? And I have an environment which has three states, 0, 1, and 2, and a state plus is 0 plus 1. So what I'm going to do to coarse grain is introduce an extra environment which interacts with the environment E so that this happens. This happens is really controlled mode, right? So this is the state of the extra environment, it's 0 plus 1. This is the state of the original environment, it's 0 plus 1. This is the state of the extra environment. So 0 inside here is going to give me 0, 0, because it's controlled mode. 1 inside here is going to give me 1, 1, after acting on the extra environment. And 2, which is here, you know, it's a sort of 3-bit controlled mode, is going to give me 2, 2. Right? So I've started with unequal probabilities, and now I have, to which I could not have applied invariance, right? If I swapped 0 with 2 and 2, tried to restore it by swapping 2 with plus, I wouldn't have gotten the same state. But now I do have a same state, right? And so the only tricky operation is getting rid of the square root of 2. I have things which equal coefficients. So I can, for example, swap this 0 with, this 0, 0 with 0, 1, and restore the state by swapping this last 0 with this last 1. I can do the same thing, 0, 1 with 2, 2, and then swap 1 and 2. Right? So it's clear that probabilities of 0, 0, 0, 1, and 2, 2 must be equal because I have equal coefficients. So therefore, each of them has a probability of 1/3. So I've sort of enlarged the system and their probabilities are equal. Now I'm going to start with the end. Probability of 2 is definitely 1/3. I'm going to assume now something about probabilities. And what I'm going to assume about probabilities is that probability of an event and its complement is 1. And here I'm assuming that, and if I assume that, I get that the sum of the other two possibilities is 2/3. So I get Born's rule. Right? Things got squared, and it's not a miracle. I mean, that miracle has to do with the fact that Hilbert space is a Pythagoras theorem holds in the Hilbert space. And so you get the right answers. Moreover, I've got it with a very limited application of additivity. I just assumed the probability of an event and its complement is 1. I haven't said probabilities are additive. This is good. The reason it's good is that in quantum mechanics, we have already an additivity principle. It's a superposition principle. And we know that there are situations where superposition principle and additivity taken sort of blindly, clash, double slit experiment. So any questions at this point? Okay. It's very clear I can apply the same strategies I applied here to 2/3 and 1/3. By the way, I didn't need to normalize this state, the way I derive things, right? I mean, all I care is the number of possibilities and the relative weights of these things. But yes?
Here it looked like the square root of 2 that got canceled came from different appearances. So it's sort of immediately obvious that it would have worked if you chose your coefficients to be something more correct.
There you go. It works out, right? So as long as the probabilities are commensurate, things work out fine, things cancel. I'm not going to torture you with this algebra, but it does work out correctly, and you do the same thing, right? You fine grain by introducing an extra environment, I call it C here for some reason, in such a way that the coefficients are equal, and then you count various possibilities, and you prove that the probabilities are squares of the coefficients which appeared here, right? If you had incommensurate probabilities, then by continuity you say, well, you can approach them from above and below, and things are going to work out. Okay. Now, relative frequencies. This is kind of busy, and I'm sort of not going to go in detail with it, but I'll tell you what's going on. But you can derive from this approach that the relative frequencies have to be the way they are. And let me just take you through some of the key steps. So I consider, as before, a superposition state that already interacted with the environment, and it has coefficients, and I'm going to assume for convenience that they are commensurate. I'm going to introduce the extra environment, and so at some point I'm going to get this sort of triplet as before, and now I'm going to, here I know what would have happened, right, by invariance, blah blah, alpha square, beta square. Now what I'm going to say is, actually, at the very beginning, I had plenty of these identical states, n of them. Each of them got entangled with its own environment, and each of them got fine-grained. Coefficients are the same, right? So I have, this product of a whole bunch of states that look like this. if I carry it out, I get a whole bunch of terms. And if I get, if I organize them so that term number one contains zero outcome zero, term number one contains one outcome zero, term number two, etc., etc., then I get a bunch of terms which are multiplied by binomial coefficients. Each of these terms, independent of where one is placed within whatever, are the same, right, according to invariance. So they have the same elementary probability. So the probability of getting n zeros is given by normalized binomial coefficient. So I have this probability here, and I know that it's going to go to a Gaussian. So in the limit of large n, this can be approximated by a Gaussian with relative frequency of ones or zeros given by whatever it's supposed to be. Question?
So why do you, for this slide, even need to go back to quantum mechanics? Because once you have established this property of probabilities, couldn't you do everything you did here? Just
Absolutely. It was okay. to satisfy referees. Okay. Anything else?
What did you mean before when you said a frequentist interpretation didn't fit?
So frequentist interpretation, which was practiced before, was practiced without the benefit of invariance. The way it was practiced in the context of many worlds, I mean, there were many practitioners, and I think some of them, like Jim, stayed away from dangers. In the context of many worlds, you basically had a state alpha 0 plus beta 1 raised to some power n, right? And so you had a bunch of coefficients which had both binomial coefficients and alphas raised to some power, right? And you still had alphas which were not defined in terms of their relevance for probabilities. So, what one did is one took, or what people did was they took n to infinity, and, you know, some of these terms went to zero and so on. But this was, you know, fairly unconvincing because, you know, alpha and beta were unaccounted for. There are significance, right? So, and this was, anyway, even the practitioners like Bryce DeWitt at some point said, yeah, this is circular. There is a very beautiful paper on many worlds interpretation in physics today that he wrote in 1971? Something like Jim might remember.
I'm right offhand.
Okay. Anyway, where he derives this, and he even makes a claim which is wrong, which was rare for Bryce DeWitt, mathematically wrong, which is that in the limit of n equal infinity, a state with this relative frequency is an eigenstate of something he called frequency operator. And that turns out to be wrong. And, you know, it has to be sort of wrong because there is half-wits here. Right? I mean, it's a Gaussian. So, you know, and here you have all, and to the problem, another problem which was brought up is there was these sorts of maverick universes, which is universes which, you know, have almost no detections of zero, or no detections of zero. And they appear in this sum. If you take that sum to infinity, yeah, the coefficients go smaller and smaller, but they are never gone. Right? So, yeah. So unless you have a separate reason to believe why alphas and zeros are tied to probabilities in a certain way, you don't have an argument. Now, there is an argument which is actually good, which predates this. It's Gleason's theorem, 1957, which does things completely differently, but he assumes additivity of probabilities. He assumes basically Kolmogorov's axioms.
So, just related to this question, is this treatment here now really satisfying for a frequentist? Because at the end, you're just saying probability almost one, you have this frequency. So, you still, in principle, are talking about probabilities.
Yeah, I mean, and it's a usual thing with probability theory. You define probability of what happens with some probability, etc., and so, you know. But here we have a invariance in the back of our mind. Summary. So we are drawing to a close. I'll go for 10 or 15 more minutes. New symmetry, joint quantum systems, joint states of quantum systems is related to causality. I haven't talked about it, but it's true. Basically, it has to do with the fact that doing something here doesn't influence something over there, right? In quantum physics, and I think number two is the key lesson, complete knowledge of the whole may imply complete ignorance of the part. Yes, it's urgent.
Kind of like a fast one of number one. I mean, the separation need not have been spatially priority, right?
It didn't, right?
So it's not obviously related to causality. You might have separated the hyperspace.
Well, it is related to causality when there is no interaction between them. Sorry, so it's sort of my fact number one. If you are not acting on this system, its state is not going to change. Right? How closely you want to relate it to causality, and you know, this is one of the reasons I didn't want to argue. And also, you know, relation to causality brings in another sort of special relativistic angle, which doesn't need to be brought up. I mean, we just got away with doing everything quantum mechanically. Born's rule, yeah. So this one, perfect knowledge of the whole may imply complete ignorance of the past. This is entanglement. Born's rule follows as a consequence. Relative frequency of release emerges naturally. New foundation for whatever we did before. In particular, it supplies new foundations for quantum statistical physics. There's a paper by Sebastian Defner and I, and we've basically restated statistical physics in a way which doesn't appeal to ensembles. One thing I hate about statistical physics is ensembles. I think they were introduced because they were introduced at the time when if you had a system, you know, you thought of a point in the phase space. If you think of a point in the phase space and you want to have an equilibrium, you can't have a point in the phase space because this point is going to run around according to Newton's equations of motion. So instead, to have equilibrium, you had to replace a single point in the phase space with a distribution of points in the phase space, each of which would run around, but the whole ensemble wouldn't change. In quantum mechanics, we don't need that. You have a system which is entangled with the environment, its state can change, and by invariance, basically, it doesn't mean that even though its state evolves under some Hamiltonian, the state you will not be able to perceive any changes. So you can get equilibria out without ensembles. Okay, and these two are partial reviews, very brief, and so on. The most important number two. And back to the program. We have one and two. How can objective classical reality states we can find out arise from a fragile quantum states that are perturbed by measurements? In other words, you know, decoherence gave us preferred states, but the way we thought about it was classical. In other words, if a state is there, you know, it's there, we're going to find out what it is. But that quantum mechanics doesn't work like this. Your measurement is going to redefine the state, or at least there is that danger. So the key idea in quantum Darwinism is to upgrade the role of the environment from what it was in decoherence. In other words, what we care about there is the imprint left by the system on the environment. The focus of decoherence was information that was left in S in spite of E, reduced density matrix of S, preferred states of S, which could not perturb. And quantum Darwinism is focused on the information about S that can be found out indirectly from the environment. In other words, right now, the whole time during the seminar, you are not interacting with me directly. You are using the environment of photons and phonons to perceive what I have tried to explain. It's clear you didn't get all of the environment. You just got a tiny fraction of each. So the key question is, how come you were able to do that? And that obviously means there must have been plenty of copies of whatever I did deposited in that environment. So the question that one can ask and analyze is, you know, how redundant is this information? Obviously, what is this information about? Preferred states will enter there. Turns out to be about pointer states. Turns out decoherence and quantum drive work hand in hand, and why does it matter? And I've analyzed it with colleagues, some of whom are listed here, and I hope Jess is going to take up the subject tomorrow. Let's see, do I want to say anything else? Yeah, maybe I'll show one more transparency since we have 8 more minutes. So, in the context of decoherence, we had a sort of monolithic environment surrounding the system, sucking out the information. In the context of quantum Darwinism, we're going to say environment is split into subsystems. Photons, phonons, air molecules, etc. And we're going to ask question, how much information can one extract from a fragment of that environment about the system? And that question can be analyzed in terms of mutual information. How many of you are familiar? How many of you are not familiar with mutual information? That usually gets... Okay, everybody's familiar. That's cool. And this mutual information is going to be defined here in von Neumann terms. It measures the increase of entropy from eliminating correlations between the system and the environment. It is a good quantity, and we're going to ask about the information that a fragment of the environment contains about the system. And the redundancy is going to be how many disjoint fragments supply the same amount of information, which is almost enough or which makes us happy. An important plot is so-called partial information plot. Here is the fraction of the environment you are able to intercept. Here is how much information about the system you've found out. This plot turns out to be anti-symmetric around the central point if you assume that the system and the environment, the whole thing, is in a pure state. This is quantum. You never get that. You never get the last few bits of the information. This is classical. And fairly quickly, you can find out almost everything. Suppose you are happy with not knowing quite everything, but almost everything. This is going to define redundancy. How many copies are there in the environment? So in other words, if this is a fraction which gives you 90%, redundancy is the inverse of that fraction. And calculating redundancy is one of the key things to do. And this shape of partial information plot is not typical. In fact, if you take a typical plot of mutual information as a function of the size of the system in a Hilbert space, which is composed of a whole bunch of Hilbert spaces, that plot is going to be sort of the opposite of it. It's going to go through the roof right in the middle and then go flatten out on the other end. Right, so these plots are the ones which happen in the case when the environment has low initial entropy and which allow you to extract that information. This transparency I have borrowed from the talk Jess gave defending his dissertation here 5 years ago? I think so.
Yeah.
Anyway, quantum Darwinism, brief summary. So observers do not interact directly with systems. Systems and observers are bathed in the environment. Here's the sun. through decoherence, many records about the state of the system are imprinted on the environment. Environment carries these records away where they can be accessed by observers, often extremely rapidly and often extremely efficiently. And there is a whole bunch of things I could say. I'm just going to give you an example of how efficient it is. This is the case of scattering of photons by a small sphere. Actually, it was one micron diameter, and Schrodinger cat, the sphere was in a superposition initially, was also one micron separation. These are partial information plots after one-tenth of a decoherence time, half decoherence time, one decoherence time. I mean, this plot becomes very sharp. Very tiny fraction of the environment will give you everything you need. Redundancy grows very quickly. And an example, again, Jess. Speck of dust, one micron separation, is going to give you 100 million copies when subjected to the sunlight in just 1 nanosecond. And this is a good place to stop. Thank you.
It was something that wasn't there
initially.
And so it's something whose dimension, you could effectively just double the system.
Yeah, what you do is you want to explore the geometry of what you have, looking for states which must have equal probabilities. So you imagine a sort of omnipotent extra observer which is going to check if the probabilities were assigned correctly in the past. So how he will do it? Well, he will do it by bringing this extra environment, getting it to interact in the ways I've specified, and checking, you know, if the probabilities worked out correctly. It doesn't have to happen. It's a tool to explore the geometry of the Hilbert space, right? It's not that it has to be there. It has to tell you when there are things equal, which are equal. It doesn't. Yeah.
So once we've derived Born-Schwarz, can we entirely discard the concept of this extra?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I mean, I would point out that you use the same trick in the frequentist approach to classical probabilities. You first say that the probability that if you have a symmetry so that all the probabilities are equal, then the probabilities are all equal to 1 over n. And then if you have things which have different frequencies, you attach an extra label to them so that the ones with the larger frequencies all individually have identical frequencies. It's the same trick.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
The geometry is slightly different, right? So, but
yes, but it's the same trick.
The fine graining, I call it.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Fine graining or whatever.
Yeah.
So there are several people, like the cubists and so on, who try to see these probabilities that come out of the model as something completely subjective. Now, in your approach, it seems to be in some way both, because on the one hand we have the states, which are certain things, and on the other hand we have this symmetry argument, which says, I mean, with the card shuffling, that I don't know what it is.
So card shuffling, I think, is they are objective. I think that's the first adjective I would attach to this. And the reason they're objective is that you know objective. You can have situations where you know objectively there is a pure state which is entangled.
So
right.
Everyone would agree on them.
And people can do measurements, providing they are clever, and actually, you know, there are some measurements which have been done in these sorts of situations to check if these symmetries are really there, right? And you know, some of these measurements use similar techniques as Bell inequalities, right? But I mean, you know, So you can verify it, right? And these things are objectively, and then you do the argument based on symmetry and you get probabilities, right? On the other hand, you know, this objective-subjective gets mangled here because you are the one who knows it's a pure state. Right, so, you know, you still know, I mean, it's not your ignorance, so, you know, you're better off. And it's not your subjective, it's just, but it could be your subjective knowledge, right? So, you know, you could be entangled with some state and you would know what it is, and I wouldn't know what you know, right? Sort of Wigner's friend situation, and this would apply.
You referred to Jess's discussion, which I'm guessing is going to be a sort of open discussion about some questions. Could you give us a synopsis of your favorite open questions that are bothering you?
Ha!
No politics.
Sorry?
No politics.
No politics. So it's so you know, each time I get to some point, like here, I think I've explained everything that could be explained. But I've been there, right? When I did decoherence, I don't know, 15 years ago, I didn't think there was any more need because you can attach Born's rule to the other axioms and do mathematics, right? So the question is, what's the next question? What's the next productive question? Right? So I think these things, you know, once you ask them correctly, turn out to be not technically sophisticated, but asking them correctly, you know, realizing that they are there and that it's worth pursuing them is it? So I don't know what it is, right?
So an open question is, what is the next one?
Exactly.
That's a good stop for the question session. Thank you very much again.